Welcome to my podcast, Why Didn't Anyone Tell Me This? With my guests, we are discussing various health issues, questions you may have about your health, and debunking some of the many myths around our health. And today, it's a great pleasure and long overdue to be talking to Professor Mike Tipton on cold water swimming, benefits and dangers. So Mike is Professor of Human and Applied Physiology in the Extreme Environments Laboratory. I love the sound of that. At the School of Sports Health and Exercise Science at the University of Portsmouth. And he has a ridiculously amazing bio. I'm not going to read it all out, but just to say some snippets. He has worked at the University of Surrey and University of Portsmouth. And in addition, he was based at the Institute of Naval Medicine from 1983 to 2004. Now, he has published over 800 scientific papers, reports, chapters, abstracts, and books in his research areas of drowning, thermoregulation, environmental and occupational physiology, and survival in the sea. Now, I've done about 250, and I've done quite a lot. So 800 is crazy. Now, Mike does very many things besides his academic work. I'm just going to read out a few. He's honorary life member of the Surf Lifesaving GB and was a trustee director for 10 years. He's a member of the Council of the RNLI, as well as a consultant to the medical director of the RNLI. And he has been involved with many groups, Royal Air Force, UK Sport, et cetera, et cetera. But I think one of the cherries on the cake, he was awarded an MBE for services to physiological research in extreme environments and the Ireland Medal for Saving Lives from Drowning Worldwide and the H&L Swiftwater Rescue Lifetime Achievement Award from the USA. Whew. Good afternoon, Mike.
Hello, Joyce. Thanks for the invitation to come and talk to you.
It's, as I said, long overdue. You are my legend for cold water swimming. But before I started cold water swimming, I very soon came across your podcasts and papers. And before I really took it up seriously, I read everything I could of yours and of Heather's, who's been on my podcast last year. And you'll probably hate me saying this, but I really look on you as a legend in, well, a legend, but absolutely a legend in cold water swimming. And you are, I tell everyone, go and check out Mike Tipton's work. So it's a total pleasure. And even better than our wonderful friend Jill Shaw has networked us all together. And Mike and I have been working on cold water swimming and pregnancy and reproductive health, which we'll talk a little bit about later. Now, my first question to all my guests is to tell me about their careers, including an insight into what attracted you to work in adverse environments.
Well, thanks for that introduction. I feel like I should employ you as an agent if you're telling people to go and read all our stuff and listen to podcasts and things. So my mother and her four sisters, it wasn't the Spice Girls. It was that group that invented girl power. And she was really into swimming and taught swimming for, I think it was about 70 years. She Wow. taught swimming, 60 or 70 years. And so I was always going to be a swimmer as a youngster, despite the fact that I'm completely the wrong shape, really. I'm more spherical than pencil-like, so, but there we are. So I was competitive swimming from 8 onwards. I think I probably stopped when in my mid-20s, and I by then was playing a lot of rugby. So I had a swimming background. So I had the common theme that runs through my life is water, really. I was in it from a very early age. And then I did a master's in human applied physiology at King's College, the second year of that course in 1982 or 83. And we visited the Institute of Naval Medicine, where a guy called Dr. Frank Golden was doing a study on swimming in cold water. And by then, I'd become very interested in temperature regulation. And human, I think everyone's interested in human physiology. Everybody is interested in how your body works and how it goes wrong and how you can make it better, etc. And I was no different. And of course, the study that Frank was doing on swim failure in cold water just meant my worlds collided in that I had an interest in swimming and I was interested in temperature regulation, how the body controlled its temperatures. And the dangers associated with going into cold, which the Navy have had a long interest in, obviously. And so that was it, really. I got chatting to Frank. It was the year of the Falklands, people will remember. So I was unable to do my project, my MSc project with the Navy, because they were busy down in the Falklands. So I went back and did a PhD there at the Institute of Naval Medicine through King's College in London on human adaptation to cold, in particular to cold water and repeated immersions in cold water. And that started a 35-year collaboration with Frank Golden. You'll see him, he and I, together on many papers, looking at the responses to cold water and the dangers, initially the dangers, because obviously that's where the Navy were coming from. And we kind of reinvented some of the dangers associated with cold water. When we started, it was primarily hypothermia that people were talking about. But I think people now understand that it's the initial responses, the first couple of minutes, that are the most dangerous. So that's a potted history, but it was just a combination of a background of swimming and an interest in temperature regulation. And like many things in my life, just being in the right place at the right time.
So I was doing my PhD at King's College in London from 84 to 87. So were we there at the same time?
Yeah, I was there from, I did my master's 82, 83. And then I was, my PhD finished in 86. So I was doing that 83 to 86. But I was based down in Gosport, near across the water from Portsmouth, at the Institute of Naval Medicine, and so I was rarely in King's. Although in those days it was on the Strand. Were you on the Strand?
Yeah, I was on the Strand. I used to drive in sometimes.
Our paths almost definitely crossed. Although, as I say, I wasn't there on a daily basis. Even the MSc I did was really pretty much remote in all the teaching hospitals and then in the military research establishment. So I didn't actually go to London very, very often.
I'm sure our paths did cross because I was there all the time, even sometimes overnight. So chances are you were there when I was there.
That sounds like a PhD, doesn't it?
Oh, God, yeah. Sometimes crying, actually. Anyway, that's another story. Yeah. Today, we are going to talk about a passion for both of us, cold water swimming or wild swimming or all the different things that you can call it. Now, I personally don't have an addictive personality at all. I'm not addicted to hardly anything, maybe chocolate. But cold water swimming has become really my addiction. And it almost happened on my first swim. I have this huge sense of euphoria. And it does continue for hours and hours. And people that go swimming with me know I'm very vocal and I'm always laughing. And I know if you're feeling euphoric, you're supposed to get out. But I'm euphoric before I even get in. Lots of laughing, lots of smiles. But obviously, I know there are benefits and dangers. So we're going to talk about both of those. But I also love it because it's exercising in nature with friends. So for me, it just ticks all my boxes. But let's start at the beginning. Mike, tell us what happens when we go into cold water.
So obviously the first tissues to be cooled are the skin, is the skin. And it is worth just remembering that about 50% of the tissues of the body are within 2.5 centimetres to an inch of the surface. We tend to concentrate and have historically on the core and talking about hypothermia and things like this. But actually, at least half of your tissues are within an inch of the surface, or 2.54 centimetres. And about 0.18 millimetres below the surface of the skin, you've got cold receptors. You've got about four times more cold receptors than warm in the skin. We're a tropical animal, so we don't like cold very much, and we're geared up to sense it, and particularly changes in temperature. All our sensory systems are more sensitive to change than to a constant environment. So, if you come out of the cinema, you're blinded by the light, but within a minute or two, your eyes adjust, your cells in your retina adjust, and you can see perfectly well. Exactly the same with the skin cold receptors. When you go into cold water, the skin cools rapidly because the water is very good at removing heat. And that change in temperature drives the dynamic response of those cold receptors, which is an enormous afferent output into the central nervous system. And that afferent output drives gasping, hyperventilation, an increase in the cardiac output, increase in the work of the heart rate, and the release of an awful lot of stress hormones. So that's your first response. And it was known about for quite a long while, but it was mostly of academic interest. And in about 1977, the Home Office published a report that I think was quite a watershed, in that we looked at it and it said that about 2/3 of those people who die going into cold water do so within 2 or 3 meters of a safe refuge, and about 2/3 of them were regarded as good swimmers. And up to that point, people were talking about hypothermia and this is the big danger. And you still hear that bandied about, people die from hypothermia in 4 minutes. Well, they don't. It's a physical impossibility for an adult to cool enough to die from hypothermia in 4 minutes. And so it's quite clear that something more rapid was happening. And so we started doing research into sudden changes in skin temperature and immersing people in cold water. And we saw these responses that I've described, and we decided that we would call them cold shock, because the medical definition of shock is quite different, as you know. But it's just a shocking experience, and it was a nice, catchy phrase that people would remember. And we think that we thought that cold shock was probably what was killing these people that were dying within minutes of going into water. And then something like the UK National Immersion Incident Survey suggested that around about 60% of those that die in the first minutes of immersion, about 20% from longer term immersions, about 20% around the time of rescue, which is a fascinating subject in itself. And so that was it. I mean, we did, that was 10 or 15 years of research summarized in a minute. But that first sudden change in skin temperature that drives the cold shock response is the first response that people get. And after that, I talk about it in terms of a cold front moving into the body. So the next tissues to cool are slightly deeper than the skin, but they're the superficial nerves and muscles. And we know from work that we and others have done that once muscle temperature gets to about 27, it stops functioning properly. You become physically incapacitated. The nerves stop firing as frequently and as well. And so you become physically incapacitated. And that can happen as soon as 10 minutes in very cold water. And then the third tissue to be impacted, or the third set of tissues, are the deep tissues. And that's hypothermia. But as I say, that's not going to happen in an adult human in less than about 30 minutes of immersion as a minimum. So most of the people who do open water swimming and cold water swimming are much more likely to experience skin and superficial cooling, that 50% of the tissues of the body that are within an inch of the surface, than they are deep body cooling.
So that all sounds quite drastic. So is it really good for us? What's the benefits of doing cold water swimming?
I should ask you, really. we've got it the wrong way around. Cold is a double-edged sword. But then I think most of the environmental stressors are, you can have too little or too much oxygen. So that cold shock response is, I would argue, is probably the thing that underpins the beneficial aspects of going into cold water. And that's quite an important conclusion to reach. I would say up front that the evidence in support of the detrimental side of cold is much stronger than in terms of the beneficial side. And I mean that in terms of mechanistic aspects. There's lots and lots of papers out there, as you know, where people who are doing open water swimming anecdotally claim that perceptually it's of great benefit to them. And I've given talks to groups like the Blue Tits, where at the end of the talk, people have been in tears talking to me about how it's changed their life and, the kind of things that you said in the introduction, Joyce. So, and I'm not disagreeing with that at all. But in terms of what's actually happening and the underpinning mechanisms, we're far less clear on that than we are on the other side of the equation, on, you know, the gasping and the drowning and the fact that you need about just one large inhalation of water to cross the lethal dose for drowning. Anyway, so what's the beneficial side? Well, we know that there's been in the background for centuries, going right back to Hippocrates, a belief that taking to the waters is healthy. The Romans had, in amongst their hot baths, they had a frigidarium, which was a cold bath. So, you know, it's been around a long while. And places like Penzance near me here in Cornwall and Brighton, you know, exist because of people taking to the waters. It really, as you know, as a pastime, exploded during lockdown with COVID, where people just found their way to the sea because they couldn't go to indoor swimming pools anymore, and numbers exploded. Now, if you ask me, and it's purely speculation, I mean, I can tell you that people say that, you know, there's three major themes you get. Firstly, you get the one that says, I'm alerted, awoken, I get this feeling of euphoria that lasts some time, which you said in your introduction. My immune system is better. I haven't had a cold since I took up open water swimming or cold water swimming. And other people say, well, there's conditions associated with inflammatory responses that are improved by cold water because it's got an anti-inflammatory component. Now, they're all claims that are made. I think we can explain the cold, the awakening and the feeling good for a bit, because that's cold shock. That's all those stress hormones that are released, and then the hormones that are released with exercise. So, the various catecholamines, cortisol, adrenaline, noradrenaline, and then things like endorphins. So I think that's probably, we have a mechanism for that. The immune system is a bit more questionable in terms of the benefits. I mean, there are some studies that suggest that short-term immersions are good for prime the immune system. Depends what markers you're measuring. There's a whole range, as you know, of markers you can measure for the immune system. And then there's actually the number of coughs and colds you get. But longer-term immersions, particularly where body temperature falls, deep body temperature falls, may well be detrimental in terms of the function of the immune system. And then the anti-inflammatory thing is probably correct, and that could have an impact on a whole range of conditions, from diabetes through to depression, because they all have inflammatory components. Again, that's pretty hypothetical, but there's a lot of anecdotal evidence to say something's happening. And I mean, for me, that's enough to some extent, because anecdotal evidence is still evidence, and I'm not going to argue with somebody that they can't tell me why it's happening. But of course, as a scientist, which I would come to this first and foremost as, I want to know what the mechanism is, because we might be able to evoke it in other ways that people who can't go swimming can then benefit from. So you could maybe to take a ludicrous example, a cold pressor test where you put your a hand into an ice bath, or your 2 feet into ice baths, could have a similar effect. The other side of the coin, of course, is because it's so multifactorial, you've already mentioned yourself that when you go to the seaside for a swim or to a lake or whatever it is, that you meet people, you've got a community, you're in a beautiful place, you're doing exercise, you've gone into a weightless environment. The studies that isolate the active ingredient in that experience have not been done. So they need to be done and be controlled for. And the other point I would make is, from a safety perspective, because I think it's probably that cold shock response that, if you deal with it safely, may well have some beneficial impacts. It doesn't follow that the longer you spend in the water, the better it is for you. But there's a natural inclination in everyone to think, well, if 5 minutes is good for me, 10 minutes must be twice as good for me. And that just doesn't follow with cold water, because as you go in there longer, you start to move towards that incapacitation. And we're seeing it. We're seeing an increase in the number of swimmers who have to be rescued because they've overstayed their welcome in cold water.
Yeah. Going back to evidence-based medicine, so evidence, I'm a scientist. It's one of my things is that we should look at evidence-based medicine. And so I was at a talk, I gave a talk in Oslo in January, and then was mentioned to the audience that I was going to go out and go to, it was minus 24 degrees, and I was going to go in the water, which was actually 8 degrees. It was quite warm. And then there was someone in the audience who said, "You've just given a talk about evidence-based medicine, and now you're going to go and do this. What evidence have you got that cold water swimming is of any benefit whatsoever?" And the audience absolutely cheered me, because I said, "Well, we have set up a research group looking at cold water swimming and women's health, and we have a paper coming out next week." Now, again, our paper is quite anecdotal, and it's a survey, but it was very good to actually say, "Well, we are thinking."
Yeah.
About it. And yeah, and I agree with you. We've got lots of anecdotal evidence for sure. And going back to the benefits, so one thing that I've really noticed, and we've talked about this before, is the adaptation of our body as we swim year in, year out. So I've exercised my whole life. I've not got any better at any of it. You know, I've just done body balance. Yes, I did body pump, et cetera, et cetera. And if anything, as I get older, I've got a bit worse. I can still do the splits. But anyway, with cold water swimming, you get better. Each year, I now only wear a swimming costume. I didn't when I started. I take my gloves and socks off quite soon now. In probably next month, I'll be swimming without them. So I think for a woman who's aging, for me personally, the fact that I feel I've got better at something like swimming that's been a big benefit as well. So tell us about how we adapt as we swim more regularly.
Firstly, you're just a spring chicken. You're still very young, so don't talk to me about aging. I can talk to you about it. I could also do the splits, but I suspect I can only do them once. And that would be that. So anyway, we are good at habituating to things, and cold is one of them, particularly the cold shock response. So if we just quickly run through it, the cold shock response, the gasping, the hyperventilation, the inability to breath hold, as few as 6 2- or 3-minute immersions in cold water will halve that response. This was a study we did many years ago. And then 14 months later, we found that without cold exposure, that response was still reduced by around about 25%. And that suggests that it's a central phenomenon, and there's also probably a psychological component to it. We confirmed that it was more central than the cold receptor adaptation, because we did a bizarre study where we repeatedly immersed one side of the body to evoke this habituation, this decrease in cold shock. And once we'd done that, we turned the body over, the person over, and then we immersed the side that had never been in the cold water and had been kept warm with half a wetsuit, and we found that there was still the same reduction. So that habituation is occurring more centrally than the cold receptors. We've also done studies where we've looked at psychological skills training. And you can significantly increase the length of time somebody can breath hold going into cold water by simply going through the standard psychological skills training package of self-talk, mental imagery. So they don't even have to go into cold water, and it will be significantly extended. So when you do actually do the cold water immersion, I think you're probably getting a combination of physiological habituation and psychological alteration. So you become less fearful of the water. Whenever we do a study, it's really noticeable that you'll say to a participant, "Look, you're going to go into water at 12 degrees Celsius, the average water temperature around the British Isles. We know that the cold shock response peaks somewhere between 10 and 15 degrees Celsius. So if you want the maximum physiological response, there's not much point in going in much colder than that." So we tell them all about it. But you can't explain cold water to people. It's like trying to explain toothache. And what happens is they go into the cold water and they get this shock because they've equated it with air at 10 or 12 degrees, which it doesn't feel too bad. And so we always see the biggest heart rate prior to the second immersion, because now they know what they're letting themselves in for. And then after that, you see it just plummet and you see the breath hold improve and the respiratory responses. So you can get a very significant cold shock response. In fact, when we immerse people like Lewis Pugh, who is the open water swimmer who goes around all the coldest oceans in the world, raising the profile of plastics in the ocean and climate change. When you put him into cold water, you can't even see on the traces where he went in. He's completely habituated that cold shock response. It's worth noting, so that's clearly a beneficial adaptation because it decreases your chance of aspirating the small volume of water needed to drown when you first go into cold water. But you still probably get the release of sufficient stress hormones, although that will be diminished as well, but you're still probably getting enough to give you that positive feeling. It's worth mentioning a couple of downsides of this habituation. And the first one is that neuromuscular incapacitation doesn't habituate. That doesn't get better no matter how many times you go into cold water. You'll feel much better going in. You'll feel more comfortable going in. But your time to physical incapacitation won't change. You just don't adapt to that because of it's a direct temperature effect rather than a neurological adaptable effect. And the third one is that actually the adaptation over the longer term is also an habituation. It's habituation of the defensive reactions to cold. So shivering diminishes and you feel more comfortable. And you develop what's called a hypothermic adaptation where you cool more quickly. And if people want to follow up on this, although hopefully they're not going to stay in the water long enough for this to be a problem, but I published a paper on the story of Jason Zerganos, who was a very famous in the 50s open water swimmer. And in those days, they didn't really know about hypothermia. And he did a swim in the Bosphorus and got very cold. And they thought he'd been poisoned. So they didn't really take any precautions. He then tried to swim from Ireland to Scotland on the Northern Channel. He got within a mile or so of the Scottish coast and basically went unconscious. And they recovered him to the support boat, and the doctor there opened his chest with a knife, penknife, and did his heart was fibrillating, and he did direct cardiac massage. And Jason Zerganos sadly died. And at no time had he felt cold. So one of the dangers of the habituation to cold that you get with repeated cold exposure is you do feel good, but you've disassociated your perception from actually the state of your body. And of course, we talk a lot about shivering and shutting down blood flow to the skin, but actually the most powerful thermoregulatory response you have is your behavior. And that's driven by temperature and particularly change in temperature, because you can achieve much more by changing what you're wearing, where you are, what you're doing, than you can by shivering or by shutting down blood flow to the skin. And if you get habituated to cold to the point where you lose that drive to behavior, it can become dangerous. And that's when you start overstaying your welcome in the cold because you feel okay. So if you're going to stay in longer than the recommended 5 to 10 minutes, whatever you do, don't rely on how you feel in the water. Base it on a time and be very strict with yourself, because people have this tendency to want to say, oh, well, I've been in 20 minutes. Well, I've been in 25 minutes. Well, I've been in 30 minutes. And they'll be able to do it and they'll feel comfortable. But all of a sudden, they'll get into trouble without any warning.
That's really important advice, because that is something that we do. We think, oh, I've stayed in a bit longer at 10 degrees or whatever. And going back to that adaptation, one of my things I've noticed, and I've asked other swimmers, I hardly ever wear tights. I hate wearing tights. So I know I'm a very hot person anyway. But this year I've hardly worn a coat, which is a bit of a shame because I've got some very nice coats. But I feel I'm just hot all the time. Nothing to do with menopause. I'm very post-menopause. But yeah, I think it stays with you out of the water. So you've mentioned some of the dangers. Let's talk more. I know there are other dangers. So what dangers do we need to be aware of?
Well, I mean, there's a whole range of them. I'm not going to get into polluted water, which is a real hot topic at the moment, but that's unacceptable what's going on in some areas where people swim. So that's one thing. There's the pollution. And then there's the physiological stuff we've talked about, which I think is critical. the most dangerous response associated with going into cold water is the initial response, is the cold shock response. And that's where you have to be careful. But by the same token, I don't think you need to stay in much longer than a couple of minutes when that, because I think it's that response that's evoking all the benefits. And as you stay in longer, then you move towards physical incapacitation and, you know, the problems of, so there's it, you know, it's just really smart. I mean, I know, I now know lots of open water swimmers that I've spoken to and worked with that will only go in for a couple of minutes. They only need a couple of minutes to get that buzz, that positivity. Now, the other conditions that people will have heard of frostbite, which in theory can occur in water because seawater freezes at minus 1.9 degrees Celsius and human tissue at minus 0.53 degrees Celsius. We're not going to get that around the British Isles, but they do have a problem with in some of the southern North Sea areas of water temperature getting below the threshold for freezing cold injury, but I think we can largely ignore it. We're much more likely to have a problem with non-freezing cold injury, and most of the people who are listening to your podcast will never have heard of non-freezing cold injury, despite the fact that it's been an enormous problem historically for the military, going, you know, right back in time. In fact, we came within a matter of days of having a problem with the Falklands campaign through non-freezing cold injury. And it's caused by prolonged cooling or repeated cooling of tissues, not to the point where they freeze, but to the point where they get shut down. I suspect we'll see an increase in it with the vogue to buy yourself an ice bath and go and sit in an ice bath, which I don't think is necessary for the reasons I said. But so non-freezing cold injury, the symptoms that people may know are they get very cold very quickly. They become cold sensitive. The area that's damaged may well be a bit sweaty, and you can get pain from it. And so most people, well, I think, are on a continuum. I mean, I played a lot of rugby. I played rugby for years and years, and got cold repeatedly, and have undoubtedly got what I would call moderate non-freezing cold injury. So I get cold hands, cold feet in particular, hard to warm them up. They're sometimes painful if I get in the cold, and they stay cold, and they're mildly sweaty, and makes you more likely to cool. So there's that. So there's non-freezing cold injury. And there's not much you can, it's been called paddy foot, trench foot, all kinds of other names for it. And I suspect that our open water swimming community, and particularly those that are going down the ice route, are experiencing or damaging their peripheral small nerves and vessels, which is the fundamental basis of this injury. Of course, the other thing that we're seeing with increased numbers of people taking to the water is we're seeing increasing numbers of swimming-induced pulmonary edema, and we're seeing increasing amounts and numbers of transient global amnesia. In fact, I've had two or three of those recently. The other dangers are, of course, that I don't think it's not peculiar to cold water immersion, but going into cold water does suddenly increase the blood pressure, the pressure put on the cardiovascular system. And we've had a number of people now who have had things like aneurysms, burst, blood pressure, cardiovascular related issues. That could happen doing press-ups, to be honest. So we've got to be slightly careful. I mean, there are things that you wouldn't go and do cold water swimming because you have. And we've written about those in a British Journal of Sports Medicine paper recently. But then there's another group of conditions that you won't even know you've got that are potentially aggravated by cold water immersion, but they would be aggravated by running or, you know, as I say, doing weights or something like that. So there's a whole range, but I mean, it's almost like I'm beginning to sound like the fun police. You know, you mustn't do this and you mustn't do that, and that's not you know me better than that. That's not my position at all. My position is I want to encourage people to engage in physical activity. We have a real sedentary problem in particularly high income countries. And, you know, sometimes I talk a lot with a friend in New Zealand about what's the most extreme environment. And probably the most extreme environment is the line of restaurants in a high street. Because it doesn't kill us immediately, but it's doing an enormous amount of damage to us later in life, and it's putting in, you know, some of the obesity related conditions is destroying our national health service. I mean, type 2 diabetes is costing a fortune in terms of its treatment. And so I don't want, you know, I encourage people to engage in physical activity, and all we do, and you do the same, is we want to make sure that they do it in a way that maximizes the likelihood of a benefit and minimizes the chance of a problem. And so that's what it's all. And there are really clear, easy things to do, you know, to ensure that that happens.
Absolutely. Can I, while we talk about dangers, can I ask you, I think you do know how many deaths there are, or roughly how many deaths there are in the UK. And I'd read that most of them are teenage boys in the summer who are drunk or stoned and jump in the water or dive in the water. Is that right?
Yeah. So in the UK, it varies a bit, but it's about 400, around about 400 deaths, 300 to 400. It varies depending on the type of year we've had. There's then a whole cohort, sadly, of suicides associated with immersion in water, where people jump into water. They're not included in the drowning statistics that we're talking about. Around about 60% of those, as I say, die in the first minutes of immersion because they've done something like tombstoning, they've jumped into cold water. The around about 25% of those deaths worldwide, worldwide, incidentally, it's at least 1,000 people a day. So it's around about 365,000. It's an enormous pandemic that's been going on years, a lot of them in low-income countries. And that number is probably underestimated because quite a few of the deaths don't get recorded. And for every death, there's probably 5 to 10 people who have life-changing injuries. So the outcome from a drowning incident can be obviously death. It can be lifelong morbidity, or, you know, no subsequent problems. So for every death, and we tend to focus on the deaths, but for every one of those, there's between 5 and 10 people who may well, you know, have particularly impaired neurological function, because it's essentially a suffocation, a drowning, and the organ that gets most affected is the brain. Yeah, so about 25% of the deaths are children under the age of 5. About 46% are under the age of about 15. So yes, the majority of those that die are young children. And I did a rough calculation for that. If you look over a 10-year period, we're losing about 100 million years of life because of people dying at 2, 3, 4 below the age of 20, rather than living to the life expectancy of the planet at the moment, which is about 70. So it's an enormous pandemic that's claiming, you know, lots of life.
Yeah, I didn't realize there were so many in the UK. So on that very depressing note, let's get a bit happier. So let's hope that some people do still want to go cold water swimming. What would your advice be for anyone who's starting out?
Well, I would make sure that you are fit and healthy enough to do it. As I say, we're a tropical animal. We want to be naked in air at 28 degrees Celsius, which is what everybody's currently doing, booking their holidays. Thermoneutral water temperature is 35 degrees Celsius, which you can only see around a narrow band around the equator. So our average water temperature is 12 degrees Celsius. So that's a pretty stressful environment. So you wouldn't go and buy a pair of running shoes and go and enter a marathon straight away. You would, you know, do it incrementally and progressively. So do the same with open water swimming. Recognize it for the stress it is. Have a medical. you'll get checked up for the things you should get checked up for. If anybody is really interested in this, we've written a paper, Cold Water Therapies Minimizing Risks, which is published in the British Medical Journal, British Journal of Sports Medicine in 2022, so just a year or two ago. And it gives advice on the kind of medical that you should be given, looking for, you know, general respiratory, cardiovascular, nervous system issues. And then if you're, once you get that, the okay on that, then, you know, join a club if you can, go with other people, go in safe places. Don't stay in for more than 10 minutes, swim parallel to the shore. There's people who have swum out to sea and then found they couldn't swim back. Don't be phased by wearing a wetsuit. I know there's a thing about not wearing one and, you know, swimming in skins, but actually the cold shock response is sufficient in a wetsuit to give you the benefits you need. Avoid prolonged breath holds. So we know that if you go into cold water and you get your face in the water and you do a long breath hold, it's a really good way of evoking cardiac problems. Mm. So, you know, keep your head above the water if you can. If you're going to put your head in the water, breathe every stroke. Don't hold your breath. Don't rely on how you feel. If you get into difficulties, float on your back, because we know that cold shock response that peaks in the first minute is gone away in a couple of minutes, hence our work that underpins the RNLI's Float to Live campaign. Use a swim float, wear luminous clothing that people will see you, as I say, go with other people, have an incremental approach, develop that cold habituation that you've discussed and makes you feel so much better. Make sure you've got a safe swimming location, preferably between flags, lifeguarded, if not, you know, something that people know about. And when you come out of the water, you'll hear quite a lot of rubbish spoken about what you should and shouldn't do. And you'll hear the term afterdrop bandied about. Well, if you've only been in the water 5 or 10 minutes, don't worry. Just get yourself warm. If you want to sit under a shower or sit in a bath, then that's fine. It's one of my bugbears is that, I mean, quite a lot of this, what we know about cold water immersion, we've actually done the original experimentation, and particularly Frank Golden and something like the afterdrop. And then you see it contorted and misinterpreted, and you can only spend so long trying to correct it. So when you come out, do just make sure you get warm. Don't worry about afterdrops if you've only been in there for a few minutes. But try and get yourself, make sure particularly your manual dexterity and is back to normal before you start doing things like driving a car. And then that paper I just mentioned also gives advice for people who are running courses for people. There's been, a big upsurge in the number of people who are putting on cold water experiences. And some of them are excellent and really want to understand the basic physiology and do it correctly. Others are in it for making money. So, you know, I would be inclined. Who do you swim with, Joyce? You swim in the Serpentine or do you swim with the?
No, I live near Cambridge, so I swim a lot in the Cam, the Ouse, lakes. We're doing lots of lakes at the moment. I can get to the sea in just over an hour. And tomorrow I'm going to Belfast. And I'm really looking forward to swimming with some Belfast people on Sunday. So whenever I travel, I try and find a local group. But yeah, I mean, everything you said is what I've always followed. Mike, I wanted to take up, there's quite a lot of myths, and you've touched on a few already. So I'm going to reel off a few and then go for it. So, and I hear opposites all the time. So we've always been told to have a hot drink after cake. To get your sugar up. Someone said the other day, you shouldn't hold a hot water bottle on your stomach. I don't use a hot water bottle, actually, but someone else did. And they said, that's not good. And then you mentioned about the getting warm after. In Scandinavia, they do the sauna to cold water, and they've done it for centuries. But then people said to me, you shouldn't get in a sauna after you come out of cold water. Are any of them true? Any of them myths? What's the situation?
That's like hours we've got to talk. the trouble is it's not myth and it's not true. It's all circumstantial. So if you start from the position that people follow the advice of not staying in the water too long. So they are in the water for a few minutes. Then just run through them again, and I'll give you a yes or a no to do it quickly.
Yeah,
hot drink was the first
one,
wasn't it?
Hot drink.
Hot drink of no use whatsoever in terms of your deep body temperature, but is quite psychologically comforting because you're actually going to warm up the mouth. You're going to warm up some receptors in the mouth. It's going to make you feel warm. It's going to make you so psychologically great. If you imagine that your average cup, let's be generous and say it's 400 mils, and you're pouring that into a body of 75 kilos of fluid, it's not going to make much difference, is it? So it doesn't make much difference to your deep body temperature, but it might make you feel good about the world, and as will a bit of cake. If you've been in the water just a short period of time, then you will not have become hypoglycemic. 5 or 10 minutes of exercise doesn't justify a piece of cake, I'm afraid. However, again, there are quite a lot of what people talk about in terms of cold water immersion is actually the perception of well-being. And if that's part of the perception, then I'm nowhere near brave enough to tell the blue tits that they shouldn't have cake. Crikey. My life expectancy would be measured in minutes. So, but you don't need to do it for, you just haven't. Now, if you're just done an hour's swim training and you come out, then there's probably a bigger argument for resupplying your muscle glycogen, which you've been using, but not for a short term immersion. What was the next one?
Well, I'll just say
we've done cake and drink.
Well, I don't drink tea and coffee. I never have, never in my life. So for me, actually, drinking hot drink is really a bit weird. But recently, even in winter, I've noticed I have stopped doing it. So I'm glad I've stopped doing it. And the hot water bottle, which I'd never heard before. Lots of women I see hold a hot water bottle to their stomach. And someone said recently, you shouldn't do that.
Right. So one of the things that cold can do, provided you've been in it long enough, again, it's a circumstantial thing, is it anaesthetizes the cold receptors. So you go from feeling very cold to just feeling nothing.
Yeah.
So you're numb. And what that means is you're not very good at perceiving whether something's burning you or not. So, if you've got somebody who's profoundly cold and hypothermic, you don't get them to warm up by a fire because the next thing you know is they've burnt themselves. So there's an element of truth in that because of the anesthetic and analgesic effect of cold on the peripheral cold receptors, and you won't know whether you're too hot or not. However, it comes back to the very fact that you want to put it on the body is just to increase your comfort. And if you've been in 5 or 10 minutes, then we have people in the lab that we put into cold water for an hour in 10 degrees. And when we come out, we just put them into a hot bath to rewarm them, because rewarming collapse has to be somebody who has been in the water a long while, has lost a lot of circulating blood volume, is hypovolemic, is borderline conscious with hypothermia. If you take those people and you put them into a hot environment, there's a chance that their blood vessels will open up, and because they've lost a lot of their circulating blood volume through cold-induced diuresis, they'll feel faint and collapse. And this happened in the Second World War when casualties were taken from the water and put into the engine room to rewarm, and they suffered rewarming collapse. It's not going to happen after a 5 or 10 minute swim in cold water. So, you can stand on the beach shivering like mad in a robe, trying to warm up with a piece of cake and a cup of coffee that will do nothing in terms of your thermal responses. But you'd be much better off just getting under a shower, and that's why people are putting stuff to their body, is they're trying to get comfortable as quickly as they can. It's potentially hazardous. Oops. If the water bottle's too hot and you've lost sensation because of the cooling.
Yeah. I lost you there for a minute. I just lost my Wi-Fi for a bit. Did you answer about the sauna? So, these Scandinavians, that seems a good thing, then, what you're saying.
Volume, so produces urine. If all of that's happened and you're semi-conscious and you're baroreceptor reflexes, which are the reflexes that maintain your blood pressure, are dulled by cooling, then it's not a great idea to go into the heat. And as I said earlier, that's exactly what happened to people who were taken from the cold water in the Second World War and put into the engine room to rewarm. It was too warm for them.
Yeah.
People who are doing open water swimming are not going to be in that state. If they're in that state, they're not going to be going into a sauna. They're going to be going into accident and emergency. So if you've been in just a couple of minutes, there's absolutely no problem with jumping into a sauna for a few minutes to warm up. With all of this, as I say, we put people into a hot bath after they've come out of the cold water. The only thing we are always careful about is you don't overstay your welcome. Just as you don't overstay your welcome in the cold, you don't overstay your welcome in the heat. And as soon as you get to the point where you feel comfortable, which will be very quickly because you're only got to warm up the skin, then you can come out. What you don't do is stay in there until you're flushed and sweating, because when you come out, then you will feel lightheaded in the same way as you'd feel lightheaded if you just climbed into a bath without doing cold water immersion before it.
Yeah, brilliant. Last question about swimming. So there's lots of women that swim. I mean, maybe it's just the blue tit thing. I don't know. But yeah, there are obviously lots of men that swim too. But as I mentioned earlier, Jill Shaw, our wonderful friend, has got us together to look at cold water swimming and pregnancy and menopause and reproductive health. What do you think we need to do around helping women? Do you think cold water swimming is helping women during some of their reproductive health issues, or during pregnancy and menopause?
I think it is. I know it is because we've just published the paper on it.
Thank you.
Just for people who are listening, that paper, which was Megan Pound and Associates, which is actually that group that we pulled together when Jill got in touch some time ago. The paper is How Do Women Feel Cold Water Swimming Affects Their Menstrual and Perimenopausal Symptoms. Mm-hmm. And quite a few of them, I was 114, you have to correct me if I get it wrong, Joyce, but it's 114 women, I think, and they talked about it reduced their menstrual symptoms, notably the psychological symptoms, the perceptual symptoms of anxiety, mood swings, irritability, and the perimenopausal women, reductions in anxiety, mood swings, low mood and hot flushes. It's an anecdotal study, and really importantly for me, and I think this is important, the conclusion to that paper was women felt that cold water swimming had a positive overall effect on menstrual and perimenopausal symptoms, and then studies on other forms of exercise to relieve menstrual and perimenopause symptoms may show similar findings. And that's a really important thing, because that's a call for studies that have control branches and control arms. But so it seems to be beneficial. We're kind of at the start of that journey, aren't we? I mean, the first thing you do is you establish that there's something going on. And then the next thing is to establish how it's going on, and when it goes on and when it doesn't go on. And it's the next step. And so absolutely fantastic that people are feeling that doing this is good for them. There's obviously a risk associated with it. We're trying to maximize the benefits and minimize the risks. But what we've really got to do now is isolate the active ingredient in that experience. Mm. So that we can say exactly what's going on, not just at a physiological level, but perhaps at a biochemical level, a molecular biological level, and that we can activate maybe those pathways by alternative means. Now, the problem we have with that is if I write a grant application, I say I want to study sudden cardiac death on immersion or drowning or hypothermia, it's much more likely to get supported than if I write a grant saying I want to look at the underpinning mechanisms of the perception of well-being from cold water swimming.
Yeah.
And until people appreciate that these non-pharmacological approaches are a better way to go, so people are not, dependent on drugs and are not able just to sit at home and do nothing, and need to go out and actually engage in that in physicality. The sooner we appreciate that, I think the more likely we'll get those studies funded. We've become what I call thermostatic. We sit about all day in temperature controlled rooms. We recreate next to the skin exactly the same temperature profile that we would have got if we were naked in East Africa, where we evolved. And we've done it through a technological thing. I mean, other animals have got blubber and fur and different things. Humans have done it, have left their tropical origins by their intellect and thereby their technology. The problem with that is, one, we're consuming Earth's resources to create that environment next to the skin that is the same as if we were naked in Africa. And the other problem is we never challenge, we don't perturb our systems that keep us fit and well. And it doesn't matter whether it's the musculoskeletal system, it doesn't matter whether it's the metabolic system, it doesn't matter whether it's the thermoregulatory system. Unless you perturb those systems, unless you challenge them, then you don't maintain the systems necessary to be healthy and control those and regulate those systems. And that, and therein underlines, you know, therein lies a really strong argument for, you know, making sure that we're out there doing stuff so that we actually keep challenging the physiological systems of the body and maintain their functionality.
Yeah, well said. I really am on a campaign to help motivate postmenopausal women to get out there, exercise in nature, be with friends. Don't go to a coffee shop. Go for a walk with your friends. And I just think the cold water is sort of the cherry on the cake for me. But you've been training for Ironman. How's it going? And have you done it before? Are you mad?
So, I mean, I've always been sports orientated, from swimming to rugby to triathlon. It was that in that order. Because I couldn't manage contact sports anymore because it was taking me too long to recover.
Yeah,
and I started doing triathlon in about when I was about 40, I suppose. And as you normally do, you progress through up to Ironman, and then I decided I would do an Ironman every 5 years, which I've done since 45. I always tongue in cheek say I do it because it's cheaper than Booper. Because if I survive the last one, then I think I'm probably okay for about 5 years. I hope that doesn't come back to bite me. So I'm currently so I've done one every 5 years. I used to do Nice. I'm for various reasons I'm not doing Nice anymore. I've switched to Austria. So I'm doing the I'm training for the Austrian Ironman in June. So my plan is to be the only, in my age group, the only person left doing it, so I can claim to be world champion, not because I'm any good, but because I'm and is it going well? On a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is going really well and 1 is it's not going as well as I'd like, I'm closer to 1 than 10. But it's an interesting thing, though, how much less spare capacity you have when you get older. When I was younger and doing them, I didn't really need much training because you've got so much spare capacity. But now I'm in my mid-60s, I find that I have to work harder and things go away much more quickly. So, you know, even between training sessions, I find I'm just not retaining that. So that's harder. And also there's lots of other pressures on you to do other things. And also there's psychologically, it's very easy. And I think a lot of people fit into this category. And one of the reasons why people are not doing exercise, because it's so much easier not to do it.
Yeah.
You say, oh, well, I'll do it tomorrow. I'll do twice as much tomorrow. And my mantra, and somebody needs to write a book on training as you get older and the psychophysiology of training as you get older, because my mantra is, learn to listen to your body and know when it's lying. Because my body will tell me almost on a daily basis that I shouldn't do anything. I should have a sit down and, you know, have some cake or chocolate and maybe do some more tomorrow. But it's lying. And so my recommendation is, whenever you get the urge, do something every day. And if after 10 or 15 minutes of doing it, you're not enjoying it, then stop doing it. but don't stop doing it before you start doing it.
Yeah. And I mean, I've had a good week. It's Friday today. I've done 2 cold water swims and I've done 5 fitness classes, a bit of everything. So a bit of sort of yoga, a bit of weight. So yeah, we mustn't, don't sit in, everyone. Just get out there, do something. Your body will be thankful, hopefully, depending on what you do. If you don't drown.
Just to give you, Joyce, just to underline how it's going, I a big step forward for the triathlon this week is I found my bike.
Has it got a puncture?
So that's good. No, I did. I had to go and get the bike, have some maintenance done. I'd probably start cycling next week. So, but I've still got 4 months.
Oh, 4 months. Okay. Right.
Middle of June.
Okay. We'll be behind you, Mike. We'll, not literally, but we'll
Yeah. No, I doubt there'll be many people behind me, to be honest.
And my final questions, which I ask all my guests. Have you heard people say, why didn't anyone tell me this? And if so, what were they asking?
I guess there's a couple of things, really. I mean, I get that question a lot from students, particularly towards the end of their PhDs, you know. and it's to do with finishing things. You know, people find it quite difficult to finish things. And people should be warned about that. So there's that. That's one thing, is that, you know, you can start on these projects, but there are people I call finishers and people who are called non-finishers. And there's a lot more non-finishers than there are finishers. So people need to be warned about, you know, every aspect of a project, I guess. The business we've just talked about exercising as you get older, I think is worth knowing, because it is a different mentality to go in an exercise as you get older. But, you know, I want to spend as much time as I can with my grandkids. So that's a pretty strong argument. And on the kids front, younger people, particularly the ones I work with, you know, are highly motivated. They often don't spend as much time with their family as they should do. And I learned that through bitter experiencing. You know, I lost about a year of holiday by not taking it when my kids were young and growing up, and that's time you never get back. So if I was to tell a youngster anything at the moment, you know, family is precious, young kids and, you know, time with family is precious, and there's nothing I would give up now that would be more important than that. So
yeah, well,
I guess I hadn't given that, you can tell probably, Joyce, I hadn't given that much thought. I didn't know about that.
No, that's great. That was one of my questions. What advice would you give your younger self? But you summed that up perfectly. So so there's two.
Yeah. Work isn't everything. The work-life balance has always been poor, but it's got a lot worse, I think, for you. I think the generation that are coming through now, I think my generation, I won't say our generation because you're younger, but my generation, I think, absolutely stuffed the place up with climate change, with financial systems, with, you know, and the sooner those guys come and take over, the better, because they have a completely different mindset.
Yeah. I keep telling you, Mike, I'm not that much. I'm 61, so I'm not that much younger than you.
Oh, yeah, but 61. Crikey, I was leaping tall buildings when I was 61.
Thank you. I'm not leaving at all. So last couple of questions. You've done so much in your life. What motivates you?
Those drowning statistics. That was the thing. You know, it's great working. I mean, we're about half of what we do is fundamental research. And then of the other half, about a third is with elite sport, a third with the military, a third with industry. And that's all great. It's lovely working with some of the elite sports people and just seeing how they perform. But if I was honest about it, working to reduce those deaths caused by drowning, unnecessary deaths through drowning, is an enormous motivation. I remember hearing those statistics for the first time back in the late 70s, early 80s. And they've just, you know, they're burnt on my memory, really. So And particularly when you start seeing just how many of those deaths are young people and how much potential is therefore lost and the contribution that they could make and the experiences they could have had. So that's the motivation. Now, you know, there are other things you do and apply your expertise in other areas, but the foundation of that drive comes from those statistics.
And the last question, what makes you happy and where is your happy place?
I'm sitting in it. From what I said, being with the family, which is now down to grandchildren, which is great. We are in Cornwall, which is a beautiful place to be all year round. I mean, it's a different kind of beauty in the winter to the summer, but I also enjoy being back at the university with colleagues and, you know, the chat and the banter and, you know, and the kind of meetings we have, Joyce, when we, you know, get together with the other team looking at the, you know, the menopause and the perimenopausal work. So, you know, it's there's lots of happy places. I'm lucky in that I don't have many unhappy places.
Fantastic. And this year, I'm going to say it on this podcast, this year, I said it last year and I didn't do it. I'm going to come down and we're going to go swimming.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, there's no shortage of places to swim.
I know.
The Perranporth group went from 25 members to nearly 1,000 over lockdown.
Wow.
So the Perranporth blue tits are there and Sarah Walsh will be very welcoming. You are more than welcome.
I'll be over soon. Mike, thank you so much. That was brimming with information and I hope to see you very soon. Thank you.
Yep. Stay safe. Thanks, Joyce. Bye.